From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 230 years ago, September 17th, 1787, when the U.S. Constitution was rolled out, its framers thought they had left behind the framework of aristocratic Europe, says my guest today, of lords and plebes. This looked like a land where every free man could have a stake. Now we've got historic inequality. And my guest, Ganesh Sitaraman, says our Constitution wasn't built to handle it. This hour on Point, economic inequality and the U.S. Constitution. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Does our Constitution have staying power as more and more wealth is concentrated in the hands of the few? Is there a crisis here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Nashville is Ganesh Sitaraman, professor of law at Vanderbilt University. He wrote about this in an op-ed headlined, Our Constitution Wasn't Built for This, in Sunday's New York Times. He's the author of the book this year, The Crisis of the Middle Class, Constitution. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ganesh Sitaraman, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
You say that the U.S. did not roll out a class warfare constitution, but that everybody else who had started down this road had. Big breakthroughs in constitutional and democratic governance here. What do you mean it wasn't a class warfare constitution? What are you comparing it to?
So if you go back to the ancient world, the Greeks, the Romans, and then through history up until the founding generation, up until the 18th century, people who designed governments, statesmen and constitutional theorists, were very worried about the problem of inequality. They worried that the rich would oppress the poor, or that the poor would overthrow the rich and try to confiscate their wealth. And this would lead to strife. It would lead to violence. It might even lead to revolutions.
So what kind of institutions did they construct? Who and where?
Yeah. So the answer in these societies was to build class right into the structure of government. So in ancient Rome, for example, you have a patrician senate for the wealthy, and you have a tribune of the plebs to represent everybody else. In England, we have the House of Lords, which represents the wealthy. We have a House of Commons to represent everyone else. And the idea is that each class is represented, has a share in government, but also a check on the other. And that's what allows for stability. And what I think is so interesting about our Constitution is we're not designed like that. We don't have a House of Lords. We don't have a Tribune of the Plebs. And the question is why? Why is our Constitution so different? Why is it a radically different Constitution than those that came before it?
Is the U.S. Senate not in some ways the equivalent? It was, after all, not popularly elected back in the day.
It's a great question. So the Senate, as you say, was selected by each of the state legislators. But the big difference with our Senate is that it doesn't have any requirements for property holding or for wealth to be a senator. In fact, senators could be rich or poor. And our Senate in some ways is actually indirectly elected just by the people. It's through the state legislatures in the original Constitution. Now, after an amendment, we elect our senators directly. But this is a big difference. It's not designed as something to represent a specific class.
Were the framers in Philadelphia in 1787 aware that they were departing from the European tradition here?
So I think the framers were aware, and the founding generation as a whole was aware of this. And I know it sounds, you know, somewhat crazy to say that this was an era without substantial economic inequality. But if we think back to what things are like in the 1780s and imagine the America of that time, it's a sparsely populated land just on the eastern seaboard from Boston down to Georgia. And they're really on the edge of the world. They're on the frontiers of the world. The center is Europe. And when they look to Europe, they see how different they are from Europe. Unlike Europe, there's no feudalism in America. Unlike Europe, there's no hereditary aristocracy in America. And unlike Europe, there are these vast lands to the west, which means that any white man, it was limited to white men at the time, could become a landowner and be economically independent and have a shot at being part of what we would think of as the middle class. And so that was the economic conditions under which they're thinking about designing a government. And that looks very different both than the aristocratic societies of Europe or these very unequal societies in Rome or in previous times.
Was this explicit back in the day, Ganesh? Did they talk about it as they put the Constitution together?
So they did talk about it. One of the interesting things in the debates in Philadelphia, they debate whether to have a class warfare style constitution, whether to have requirements for the wealthy. Outside of that, in the ratification process of the constitution, there are debates about this. And one of the striking things is how people on all sides think that America is shockingly equal and that we're in a unique situation, an exceptional situation compared to Europe and compared to other countries.
You're talking
in the history
of the world. As the Constitution was being written.
As the Constitution was was being written and in the ratification process in all of the states.
So what did they say? Did they think this inequality would never be an American problem, that was something left behind?
So there was a debate about this, and you know, one of the founders, Charles Pinckney, he expected that we would never have this problem for centuries. There would not be a problem of inequality. Others, like John Adams, thought there would be a problem with inequality immediately or almost immediately. And in the middle, there were some people like James Madison who projected that at some point in the future, this might be a problem, but the safety valve of having the West available would really defer this for a long time, and it would be up to future generations to figure out what to do when this became a problem.
So describe in our Constitution how you see it. You call it a middle-class Constitution. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean by the middle-class constitution is that the constitution is based on the assumption that our society will have a large middle class and relatively little economic inequality, relatively little divide between the very rich and the poor. And that's not something that is explicitly mentioned, but it's implicit in the structure of our constitution because we reject having these specific classes within the structure of our government like the Romans did and the British did.
I'm trying to picture why you presume that this would have been a middle-class economy and there was so much equality. I mean, look at the framers. I mean, among them, there's George Washington, first president, big plantation owner, Thomas Jefferson. We know his lovely place. I think of others who were there who must have been among the more wealthy of their day.
It's a great question. And, you know, the founding generation, many of the people who were at the Constitutional Convention in the first Congress were relatively wealthy or on the top end for their day. But the question is, what are we comparing this to? And so you mentioned George Washington, who's a great example. You know, Mount Vernon is a beautiful home. He's got some very large grounds there. But if you compare that, for example, to the palaces of the dukes and duchesses in England, there's just no comparison. You know, the Duke of Marlborough's palace at Blenheim can eat Mount Vernon for breakfast. And that's a big shift. The level of economic inequality was just nowhere near what people saw in Europe. And so on that comparison, which is their baseline, America looks surprising in how equal it is.
Did they worry about the dynamic of the haves and haves not? Did they worry about oligarchy emerging, or they just thought that was truly a perpetually un-American problem?
No, they did worry about it, and there were a lot of people who were very concerned that this would be a serious issue. There were some people who advocated at the time that we really needed to have one of these class warfare constitutions because they were worried about this problem. You know, one of my favorite quotes is from a guy named John Taylor, and what John Taylor said in 1814 is that when the rich plunder the poor, it is slow and legal. And what he was worried about was that over time, you would see an economic inequality divide, and the wealthiest people would, through the laws, start reshaping the political system to serve their own ends. Now, on the other side of the story, what people worried about was that if you had this emerging oligarchy, you would see the people revolt against it. And they would do that by looking to someone who would be their leader, and that person would use populist demagoguery to try to gin them up, and that you would end up again in this cycle of strife. And so they were concerned about this problem, but what they did is they trusted to politics, and they trusted to people to pass laws, to expand the country, to invest in the future, so that this wouldn't become a perennial problem.
Is it fair to describe this era as not so concerned about economic inequality when built into the Constitution was straight up slavery? I mean, talk about inequality, you can't get much more unequal than that in terms of freedom and in terms of economic power.
Completely agree. And, you know, one of the things is from our modern perspective, as we look back on this era, we have to recognize that level of inequality and we should condemn it. It's wrong and that is just a fact. But one of the other things we have to do if we're thinking about history is if we have to go back and put ourselves in the mindset of people who were living at that time in order to see what they were thinking was radical about what they were doing. And so here's how I would describe it. The tradition that I've talked about, this middle-class constitutional tradition, says that you have to have relative economic equality within the political community. But it leaves open a huge question. Who's in the political community? And this is a question that's been debated and fought over, including violently, during our history. But I think we can identify another tradition, a tradition of inclusion that expands our political community over time and has expanded it to include minorities and women. And one of the real challenges that we face is how these two traditions intersect. Because when you expand the political community, you then have to ensure that everyone in the political community can be in the middle class for our constitutional system to work as it was designed. And what I think is so amazing is that people throughout our history understood this. And so after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, for example, Thaddeus Stevens, one of the leaders of the Reconstruction movement in Congress, a congressman from Pennsylvania, he proposed confiscating the wealth of the top 10% of Confederate planters and redistributing that to their former slaves. And this was in 40-acre parcels. This is where we get 40 acres and a mule from this time period. And the reason why is because he believed it wasn't enough just to have political and rights and civil rights. You also had to have economic justice and economic equality for there to be a true republic. And so I think that's a theme that we've seen throughout our history, is trying to work out the tensions between inclusiveness and economic equality.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. Constitution and how it holds up in our time of historic American inequality. My guest is Ganesh Sitaraman. He's authored the book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. So also, interestingly, senior counsel for Massachusetts Democratic U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, when she first entered Senate, had worked for her campaign there as well. He's a professor of law at Vanderbilt University and joins us today from Nashville, Tennessee. You can join us as well. What do you think? Does Ganesh Sitaraman overstate the problem? Or do we have a crisis here? Do you think the founders anticipated the kind of inequality that we have today in 2017 America in the U.S. Constitution? Did they write a middle-class constitution? What if that middle class is in big trouble? What if it's imploding? Ganesh Sitaraman joins us from Nashville. What are you saying out of this, Ganesh? Are you saying, scrap it, go back, we need a House of Lords and a House of Commons here, call it like it is, rewrite it? What's your proposal?
Well, so I think the real question is we have a mismatch between our economic conditions in society and the document that we have. And I think there's two solutions that we could debate here. One is, as you suggested, we realign our Constitution to fit our economic conditions. And that would mean rejecting the idea that we're a middle-class nation. That would mean reinstating something like a House of Lords or a Tribune of the Plebs. And in fact, there are some commentators who've actually suggested doing things like that.
Now, why would that help? Why wouldn't that just be cementing a situation that we all kind of hope is cyclically passing, that we get back to some, more reasonable distribution? Why would it help to put it in the Constitution?
So I agree with you. I think those are probably not going to be workable solutions. I think they're unlikely to be passed in the first place. But they suffer from a real problem, which is anytime you design a structure like that, it's still susceptible to there being influence from the wealthiest people. So there's no reason to see why, for example, if we had a new House of Lords, we wouldn't still see money influencing the House of Commons that we had. And so we have this pervasive problem that money will find a way. And so what I think the right solution is the solution that most Americans have pushed forward through our history, which is politics. We have to have policies that we work on that try to improve the standing of our middle class and reduce inequality in the country. And I think if we pursue that course, we can preserve both our constitutional system and our deep interest and values in being a middle class country.
You quote Teddy Roosevelt, who wrote, "There can be no real political democracy unless there is something approaching an economic democracy." But if the Constitution wasn't set up for our reality now, does it actually hinder or not support reforms that might boost the middle class?
So one of the extraordinary things about our Constitution is that it's really short. It doesn't have a lot in it. And if you compare it to constitutions around the world, many of them that have been drafted in recent decades are very, very long and detailed. Ours is short. Often it's pretty vague. But what that's meant is that it's a constitution that can adapt to the various changes that society faces and to the crises that come and go. And so we've made it through wars. We've made it through depressions, in part because our system of government is flexible. And so I think we have the opportunity to do a lot with our politics. Now, one of the challenges, though, is that often we can have a court that chooses to restrict what the political system is able to do. And I think that's one of the serious threats, is if a court defines the Constitution to mean something very restrictive, it becomes harder for our democratically elected officials to actually be able to put in place the changes that we need to adapt to modern times.
Shada in Boston is calling. Hi, Shada. You're on the air with Ganesh Sitaraman.
Hi, Tom, and thanks so much, Ganesh. I really appreciate your insights. And it sounds like you're saying that the founders basically didn't think that they needed to prepare a constitution that would deal with the issue of class warfare because of the escape of the West, which to me sounds kind of tantamount to indigenous genocide. And I was wondering how much you think the institution of slavery also factored in as a kind of outlet for white men to get out from class struggle.
It's a great, great set of questions. And I think both of those are really important insights. So the idea of the West and being able to expand into the West meant taking land from Native Americans. And this was not something that through much of our history, the people who were taking that land cared much about in terms of the rights of the people who were there. So that's certainly part of what went on and what was the story that enabled the system to operate, or at least how they thought it could operate. And then your point about slavery is also right. You know, one of the most interesting things I talk about in the book is the people who were advocates for slavery in the 19th century leading up to the Civil War. And it's surprising to see how they are willing to pervert or abandon almost everything that we think about as American ideals of government just in order to find a way to support slavery. And deep down at part of it is a combination of racism and a view that there has to be some sort of underclass in order to do a certain set of labor. And what they do is betray a variety of our best traditions. And then the Civil War wipes that out. And I think we see in Reconstruction, as I mentioned earlier, a time when people, particularly in the North, are really trying to push forward a new vision of how to think differently about race and class. Ultimately, they fail, of course.
You're talking the progressive and populist movements of that time.
The progressives and populists, coming even afterwards, are pretty interesting people, and I think instructive for how we think about the world today. You know, in the late 19th century, there are massive changes in our economy. There's industrialization, urbanization, the closing of the frontier, the move from agricultural and artisanal work to wage labor in factories, the rise of corporations and monopolies. And what populists and progressives say is that these fundamental economic transformations are changing the nature of our economy and are a threat to our constitutional system, a threat to our republic. And so they propose a bunch of changes to try to address the imbalance between the economic realities and political democracy. So they propose antitrust laws to break up big companies. They pass a constitutional amendment to have an income tax so the wealthier will pay more. They try to create minimum wages so that working people will get paid more. And then at the same time, they try to block economic power from influencing political power. So the first campaign finance reform laws come up in this period. And they switch the approach to selecting senators from having the legislature select them, where there was a lot of bribery going on, to having the people elect the senators, which is more democratic. And so this was an era when there was a lot of flux happening, but people understood that they needed to make changes to adapt to a modern industrial society.
Larry in Charlottesville, Virginia. Larry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment that the average American person does not buy into this socialistic agenda. You can make it in this country if you're willing to go out there and work hard. That's the very reason that people elected Trump, because they're rejecting this message. That's why we have a new president that doesn't line up with this. Life's not fair. There will always be rich. There will always be poor. Quit whining and go out and go to work.
Larry, I am all for the opportunity piece of that. Believe me, you know, especially coming where I came from. But when I look at the mobility numbers about those who actually succeed in moving up in our country, and I see we're falling behind Europe on that front, that gives me pause. Does it bother you?
Not really. I mean, we are our own country, and there's going to be rich and there's going to be poor. This still is an opportunistic nation. If you are willing to work hard, educate yourself, if you have that opportunity, go out there and work. I mean, it's look around the entire world as a whole. We are a blessed nation.
Well, I mean, I get it, but there was a time when we led in economic mobility, you know, when we were rising up. And now we don't lead in that, and we've got more division between middle class and rich than I've ever seen in my lifetime. I don't know about you, and it just makes me think. But you're saying no problem whatsoever?
Not no problem, but if people would just quit whining about it all the time and go out there and make it better by making their life better.
Yeah,
I mean there's going to be a divide. That's just life. That's just life. That's the way life is. So yeah, overall, no problem. I'm blessed to live in this nation.
I'm all for that. Ganesh, you hear Larry saying this is pushing a progressive or socialist agenda here. Just get out there and work at it and stop whining about the Constitution.
I'm all for people working. I think economic opportunity is incredibly important. I think hard work is incredibly important, and I don't think there should be excuses for not working hard. But one of the very important things also about our country is that when people succeed, we all succeed because we're part of a community that helps us succeed. We've had teachers who've invested in us. We have parents and family members who support us. We have friends who support us. And it turns out, actually, the government's been very helpful in doing a lot of things that help us succeed. We pay taxes to government to build schools, to build roads. Those things help businesses actively recruit employees. They help businesses get goods into sale. Those investments that we make as a country are actually really good for opportunity, because I think they give us the foundations that each of us need to succeed and to be able to work hard. And so I think that's something we need to support. And one of the real challenges is, I think right now, for some years, we've not spent enough time thinking about how we can invest in our future and build the kind of opportunities for young people, for our kids, that we need to.
So no crisis in Larry's view, just go get it. Maybe a crisis of whining, he says. But Michael in Natick, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on.
Yes, I think Barry is in theory right. But the problem is the system isn't just go out and work. The system is if you make a lot of money investing, you pay much less in taxes. You don't pay towards Social Security on that income as you would on wage income. We penalize workers compared to investors in a serious way. The system, and this is why Hillary lost, she didn't understand that people are afraid and angry and hurting because the system has become more and more rigged. And part of this goes to the Constitution, because even though I agree it was a middle-class Constitution, because you need education and relative, some leisure time and everything to be involved in politics as a sovereignty through the people, and the Senate was supposed to be a check on that, as sort of an almost House of Lords, to slow things down, cooling the teacup, the cup and all. But the bottom line is that at the end of the day, you know, we FDR couldn't get programs through because the Constitution didn't allow it until the judges decided that all the WPA and other programs were constitutional, and the safety and minimum wage and all that were constitutional. They weren't until they were. And the same was true you know, you had slavery being okay and separate but equal being okay until the Supreme Court said, no, those things aren't okay, and you have equal rights and women have a right to vote and all the rest. And so the bottom line is that in the last 10 or 20 years, having a few too many right-wing judges, and I think the closest we had to a moderate were Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor, who said the biggest mistake of her life was voting to give George Bush the presidency in 2000, stop the counting. And the bottom line is that the Supreme Court can do it. Ironically, when we most need to change the Constitution because something isn't working, it is least capable of being changed because you need an informed electorate that's rational and thinking not from fear, but from awareness and confidence to make changes rather than have it become subject to. Imagine if the Trump voters were changing the Constitution today and what it would be made to look like and how crazy it would be and how unhelpful it would be to the goals that those of us who might want to change things have. I mean, the bottom line in all this is, if we just last week or 2 weeks ago, gerrymandering in Texas, if you couldn't gerrymander, if you couldn't do voter suppression, then you'd have real, then it would be self-correcting. The problem is that when you have an underclass with education and an underclass when it comes to the ability to get to polls and be informed, and couple that with doubt casting on news, or even more so, you have a few very wealthy people that say, we're going to influence the process so Citizens United is the law of the land, and we can contribute $1 billion like the Koch brothers and essentially buy elections all across the land.
Michael, we got it. And with all that, you don't see it changing when perhaps you think it should. And we've got it, and I appreciate your call. We're looking at the U.S. Constitution, the middle-class Constitution, says my guest today, and whether it's up to our times. All right, Ganesh, back to back there. I mean, Michael is kind of highlighting the point that is implicit, or maybe more than that, in what you're writing here, that because of inequality and the political influence of money, the system is bound up and not really responding. Is that the crisis you're talking about as you see it?
Yeah, one of the central things that's happening when people say the system is rigged is that they're seeing the interaction between economic inequality and politics. And what happens is when you have an unequal society, the wealthiest people, corporations, interest groups can lobby Congress, they can invest in campaigns, and they can change the rules or rig the rules in order both to promote their own wealth. And so our caller just talked about the differential tax rates for some of the wealthiest people compared to many working class people. And so you see that happen. And what that does is it perpetuates the wealth of the wealthiest, and it makes it harder for anybody else to get a leg up. And so I think one of the challenges is that we have this this vicious cycle. One commentator has called it the doom loop of oligarchy, that the rich just get richer, they influence politics more and more, and that just helps them get even richer, and then they can even more influence politics. That's a cycle that's going to be very hard to break out of. And I think one of the challenges we have today is figuring out how to mobilize so that we can break out of that cycle and actually have some real change.
You're talking about political mobilization, though, to change the Constitution or to have another progressive era. Is that your goal?
I think our Constitution's flexible enough that if we have enough political mobilization to change policies, we may not need to change the text of the Constitution. Now, as one of our callers said, I think one of the real challenges in this space where we may need to change the text of the Constitution is campaign finance reform, where for many years we've seen the Supreme Court increasingly shrink the amount that Congress can actually regulate money in politics. And I think that's a detriment to our political system and to policy.
So here we stand. Beyond the imagination, you're suggesting, of most of the framers of the Constitution, and yet they had seen this play out again and again in the old country, in Europe.
That's right. They had seen this play out in the ancient world, in Europe, and it was something they were concerned about. And I think one of both the extraordinary things about the framers and maybe one of their more myopic moments was in not thinking that we need to build some structures in to help us address this problem. And I say maybe that was extraordinary because they did trust to people to be able to experiment, to innovate, and to adapt, and to be engaged in the political process. And that was something that was very important, that we had engaged citizenry that would address the kind of problems that the country was facing. And I think that's what we need today, is people who are really engaged in our political system to solve these problems and save our republic.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. Constitution and how it holds up in our time of historic American inequality. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us. He's author of the book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, saying it wasn't built for the extremes of inequality that we have in our economy now. Former senior counsel for Massachusetts Democratic U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, professor of law at Vanderbilt University, and joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. Constitution on people's minds as it hits 230 years of age. On Thursday, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein delivered a speech at the Heritage Foundation to mark Constitution Day, September 17th. He told the story, well known, of the woman named Mrs. Powell, who stopped Benjamin Franklin on the street after the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, asking what sort of government the founders had created.
Franklin replied with these words, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Now, Mrs. Powell's question illustrates that it was not inevitable that our nation would begin as a democratic republic. And Franklin's answer reminds us that it is not inevitable that our nation will remain a democratic republic. Franklin realized that the Constitution comes with a condition. You need to keep it.
Of course, the debate is around what keep it means exactly. Ganesh Sitaraman, please stand by there in Nashville. Michael Greva joins us right now from Alexandria, Virginia, professor of law at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, author of The Upside Down Constitution. He reviewed Ganesh's book, and you can read his review at our website. It was in the Wall Street Journal. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor Greva, thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy Constitution Day.
Same to you, sir. Your review starts out in rather complimentary terms toward Ganesh and his work here, but ends up with a different conclusion. What do you make of his concern?
Let me say at the outset, what comes is a lot of disagreement, but we agree on a whole lot of things. This is a very, very important book and a very serious book, and so congrats and thanks. Here's the central disagreement is, I think, this, and this came out in some of the phone calls. What Ganesh is preoccupied with and what a lot of people are preoccupied with is the distribution of income, inequality in that sense. And that is not true of sort of Aristotle and the founders and people who were obsessing about the middle class in the 19th century. What they were concerned about was production, right? So you need sort of a certain middle class, not in the sense of they earn the median income, but in the sense that they are independent producers. And we've lost a little bit of that, right? Those people, Larry called, I don't even have to guess what he's doing for a living. He is probably sort of an independent, sort of small businessman. And he gets to run around in a non-working government everywhere he looks. And that is what makes him upset.
But you're talking about the yeoman farmer of the Constitution framing days.
Look, what they celebrate is artisans, yeoman farmers, right? 40 acres and a mule. That's not sort of the road to riches. That is probably a hardscrabble existence, but it makes people into sort of independent people, independent citizens with whom you can run a country, a free country.
So is it your assertion then that they didn't care, they would not have cared or didn't care about the idea of vast inequality in wealth and income? That didn't matter to them? That would not or did not worry them?
Look, at some point, the sort of incomes matter, right? Abject poverty and sort of a proletarian rabble in the streets. You can't have that in this country. And at the other end of the spectrum, I mean, stupendous wealth ought to be used for beneficial purposes as it is today. That's why Bill Gates and these people have a foundation and give away a lot of their money. But that's not the central problem. You have to have sort of citizens who can stand on their own feet. And that means they themselves have to, in some way, as the Marxists would say, own the means of production and own their own living. You can have a thought experiment. You can sort of reduce inequality by taxing the living daylights out of people and then create a gargantuan bureaucratic state, okay? Mm-hmm. And some European countries have had that. would that be the country that we want to live in? I really, really doubt it. Right? Which is why we sort of celebrate sort of small business and all the rest of it to this day.
You note in your review that Ganesh Sitaraman foresees the corruption and hollowing out of the constitutional order, a plutocratic regime, you write, run by and for a small moneyed elite. Is that a fair fear or even reality at some level, Michael?
Oh, it's a huge fear. I am very, very concerned about it. I don't know quite how it relates to sort of inequality per se, but what you have is a government that is becoming much more presidential, much more executive-led. Congress is a bunch of clowns and sits on the sidelines and sort of has a sort of approval rating somewhere south of Lindsay Lohan.
But what about the plutocratic face of this that you note there?
Well, it goes both ways, right? I don't think it's fair to say that it's sort of run for the rich. It may as well be run for the president's friends, whoever they may be.
Ganesh, what do you make of the review that you got here from Michael Grieve? He's complimentary in some ways, but he comes down in a fundamentally different place. It's about independence, not about wealth or income.
So I actually agree with a fair amount of what Michael said there. There's a strong tradition, as he points out, in the 19th century of people being independent, workers as artisans, workers as farmers, as yeoman farmers. And that's a really important part of what it meant at that time to be middle class, to be part of a relatively equal society, and to be independent. One of the challenges, though, that I think has happened is our economy is fundamentally different now. We have massive corporations, multinational corporations. In many sectors of our economy, we see a fewer and fewer number of companies that control and dominate in those sectors. And so the nature of our economy is just very, very different than one that sustains the idea of independent yeoman farmers, small artisans, and so on. And so one of the questions is, how do we translate our current system to either fight that change that's happened or adapt to that change that's happened? And I think throughout our history, we've seen people try to take both tacks. So we've seen in some cases adaptation, which is, maybe it's redistributional taxes or programs like healthcare that help people in the middle do better and take off some of the costs on their expenses. On the other hand, we've seen policies like antitrust laws that try to break up big companies in some cases. And so I think there are different strategies to how to address this problem, but that's one of the big concerns, and it's one of the changes that's happened since the 19th century.
Michael Grieve, I'll bring it to you. Let me get a couple of callers here. Anna is calling from Waukesha, Wisconsin. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I think it's very interesting, the two points of view that your guests have. And I kind of have a different one. So like you said, I'm from Waukesha, Wisconsin. We're about 15 minutes outside of Milwaukee. And as a good old Midwestern town, we don't see the Constitution as something that is even being followed very much anymore when it comes to modern-day politics. And I don't think it was that the framers didn't care. I don't think they could have ever predicted that not only would we become a gargantuan country with these massive companies, you know, like Foxconn that's coming to Wisconsin, but that we would have the moral ineptitude to not look at the Constitution as something that the framers bestowed upon us to show us a way to build a country, but as something to find the loopholes through. And I think that's kind of the rabble that we're in right now in modern day politics, especially with the president that we do have. I mean, we have someone who is literally a mascot for the top 1% as our president. And for me, it's...
Do you worry, Anna, that the plutocracy or oligarchy has come to pass?
I think it already has. You know, I live in the middle class. I own a small business. My husband works in construction. We have an infant son. And we cried when Trump got into office because we realized what this meant for us as the middle class. Because men like Donald Trump, who have bankrupted and destroyed lives so that they would only have to pay 30% of a tab, do not care about the middle class. They care about trickle-down economics and filling their coffers.
I know, and we've got it. And let me pick it up right there, if I may. And I appreciate your call. Michael Grieve, You're worried about bureaucracy drowning independence and personal agency, and I get that. Anna's worried about, you know, independence being drowned by a kind of concentration of wealth, and says we've already got an oligarchy. What about it?
Look, I share the worry to some extent, right? But what you want to worry about, it seems to me, is, and I said this in so many words, mm-hmm. Is sort of political system that is corrupt in, not in the sense that people do favors for each other, that happens all the time, but in the sense that the entire political system becomes sort of mobilized for political partisan purposes. That is what the founders were worried about when they talked about corruption. And yeah, sure, I agree that that is a serious problem. But to repeat, I mean, I don't think that has anything to do with the distribution of income. That has to do with an awful lot of other things. And for what it's worth, I mean, I don't think that most Americans sit around and worry about, you know, the awesome power of Google or Amazon. What they're worried about is that sort of the institutions that ordinarily ought to make their lives work don't function anymore.
I guess they wonder why they don't. And, you know, you're right. Some will look at bureaucracy and some may look, in fact, at the very kind of corporations that Anna's talking about. We're looking at the U.S. Constitution and whether it is up to designed for our current levels of inequality in this country. Ganesh, you point back to the progressive era and the populism then as having found a response in the late 19th century. Now we have a populist president. Again, I mean, he ran a very populist campaign. What does that tell you about where we are, the complexion of populism that we're looking at right now?
So I think one thing that we have going on in the country is we have lots of different populisms. On the one hand, we had populism with Bernie Sanders, who ran for president, got a lot of support from people on an agenda that was both inclusive and populist economically. He's a self-described socialist even. On the other hand, we had populism from Donald Trump, then candidate Trump, which was both populist in a sense of being not inclusive in terms of who was the focus of the political community, but also was populist on some economic issues that he talked about in the campaign. And I think what's been interesting to see as he's become president is how much of the economic populism seems to have taken a back seat, even where there might have been opportunities to do something for people who are really struggling. And so, you know, I think we have this odd complexion of populism of different types. And one of the things I think that actually gives me hope in the country right now is for all our divides and for the deep partisanship that exists, there is something that people who support Bernie Sanders, people who support Donald Trump, people who think the system is rigged but supported any number of other candidates for president can agree that we have a problem and that we really need to do something about it. And that's something we share, and that's a foundation that hopefully we can build upon.
Benjamin in Gastonia, North Carolina. Benjamin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Well, one thing that I have to say is that the Founding Fathers actually did predict this, and they did make a law saying that we can't overthrow and replace the government if they are treating us unfairly, or the few people who are leading the nation. Another thing is that about the minimum wage, Thomas Sowell, an economist, actually talks about this. And he says minimum wage is actually to the detriment of the people, because if we would actually were to go up to a guy who's offering us a job and we'll say, hey, I want to get paid $15 an hour, he'll say, no, $7.50, that's the minimum wage here. And so, but if there was no minimum wage and I'll go up to him and I'll say, hey, I want $15 an hour, he might take it down to 10. So in fact, that I might be earning less. So I'm more of a capitalistic guy.
Ben, we got it. And looking to revolution, if it comes to that, Michael Kreva, you know, I don't know about a law for revolution, though there was certainly always a spirit that people had to stay on top of the reality of the American circumstance and respond to it. Do you think the country, you know, Ganesh is worried that the country is not being responsive to the problems we're seeing right now. How do you think we could be more responsive to fix it, Michael?
actually, I mean, a huge point of agreement between Ganesh and myself. I think we are sort of at an sort of inflection point, and it would help if people thought a little more seriously about sort of the connections between, you know, the way the country works and the economy looks on the one hand, and the Constitution on the other. A big part of this is sort of a cultural shift, in the sense that, you know, it would be good to educate the next generation in the importance of these things. And candidly, it sounds like a suck up, but sort of conversations like this are a hugely important thing, because the entire political discourse in this country has sort of degenerated into sort of a shouting match on the one side, and sort of infinite complexity and stuff you can't comprehend on the other. And so there has to be sort of a mid-level sort of conversation about what the country is about. And I think that's a hugely important starting point.
Michael Greva at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ganesh, where's your hope?
My hope is that we can all come together and actually have conversations like this that really push forward the idea that we need to do something about our economic system. We need to do something about it in part to save our republic, our constitutional system. And this week, 230 years after that document came out, I think it's fitting that we're having this discussion.
Well, that's putting a lot on the line. Ganesh Sitaraman raises a big question about whether our Constitution is up to the challenges of the inequality of this country right now. The book is The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution. Ganesh Sitaraman at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.